Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the 23rd day of November, 2019. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and let's try to wrap up a week that's one of the most obscenely ridiculous, even by recent standards, in memory. And on that score, we'll probably have to work up to the worst of the Swamp Circus. But let's start here, at least, just to get ourselves in the right mood. Courtesy of Paul Joseph Watson, first anyway, at Summit News. But ultimately, Glenn Greenwald at The Intercept, along with Zero Hedge, whole lots of commenters from all over the web, and even the New York Times, at least, kinda, sorta. Here we go. What now passes for a journalist at the New York Times praised the woman who should have been queen, according to them anyway, Hillary Clinton, for wearing a white pantsuit a while back, but this week called Tulsi Gabbard a cult leader for wearing pretty much exactly the same thing. Style writer Vanessa Friedman drooled over Hillary's clothing choices back in 2016, calling her white pantsuit presidential. But when Gabbard, now a fierce critic of Clinton, wore exactly the same outfit, Friedman said it made her look like a cult leader who was full of, quote, combative righteousness, and that the white fabric has, quote, connotations of the fringe, well, now that she's worn it anyway, rather than the center, and even undermines community building. Glenn Greenwald summarized it brilliantly by putting up both of the paper of record stories. The banner from the New York Times a while back was entitled, Why Hitlery Wore White. They didn't spell it right. But the picture this week had a whole different spin. Wrote Greenwald, same author, same newspaper, completely different claim. And he added subsequently that yes, while it's usually misogynistic to attack a female politician for the clothes she wears, obviously an exception will be made in this case. I'm just gratefully continued, the New York Times didn't claim white pantsuits were Russian. I was waiting for a Kremlin or Putin link. Tweeted somebody else a bit later, obviously, only neoliberals and war hawks can wear white pantsuits. And it kind of makes your host wonder, is being allowed to criticize someone's choice in clothing the new, now acceptable form of far-left politically correct racism? Or is Friedman just a pantsuitophobe? I guess, however, it's just possible they really do hate anything and everything white that much. When it comes to the only story that the fake waste-stream media really thinks is worth covering, the shift storm that engulfs Washington entered a whole new phase this week. No longer content with just parodying the government of a once-free nation and assaulting the intelligence of those who watch their antics, they've moved way beyond the point where even calling it a circus insults the memory of P.T. Barnum. Thursday's chief test-a-liar, Fiona Hill, who's so much of a George Soros plant that she still looks like a philodendron being watered and fertilized by a pile of Adam Schiff, really demonstrated this week just how far down the Schiffer these people intend to go. The headline from Jim Hoft at the Gateway Pundit says just about everything I want to talk about when it comes to what this sellout had to say. Thursday's witness Fiona Hill, it begins, has links to Soros, the deep state, Fusion GPS's Chris Steele, and conveniently even managed to forget the name of the one who shouldn't be named anyway, Eric Sciaramella, during questioning. And how's that for credibility? As if the ringmaster for the House impeachment cared about that in the least. TGP notes that it was InfoWars that first blew the whistle on this particular piece of the Schiff team, saying they were contacted by sources close to the president, confirming their suspicions that Fiona Hill was definitely one of the so-called White House whistleblowers involved in the current Ukraine witch hunt, and they first reported that Hill worked as a mole for Soros, having connections to the evil one that go back at least to the turn of the century, when she worked for 6 years for the Open Society Institute. And catch the irony in this, too. InfoWars first reported that Hill worked as a mole for Soros when Trump confidant Roger Stone broke the bombshell back in May of 2017, revealing that Hill was serving as Soros' mole under the supervision of former NSA advisor, good riddance, H.R. McMaster. And we know what the deep state did to Roger Stone, and I guess it's increasingly obvious why. Hoff goes on to outline her connections to none other than Christopher Steele, Professor Joseph Mifsud at the center of the storm with George Papadopoulos, and even Clinton crony Strobe Talbot. And, perhaps to no one's surprise who's been paying attention, she has connections to the shiftless one as well. What she doesn't have, however, is any actual knowledge of the dreaded phone call that the duly elected president made with the newly elected president of the Ukraine on July 25th, because she was outed and resigned before that. And maybe that explains the only part of her testifying that's worth at least a chuckle. The Washington Examiner reported that when former National Security Council official Fiona Hill testified before the House Intelligence SIC Committee, she said she couldn't remember the name of the Ukraine director when she joined the White House. You want to guess why, folks? Yeah, the name was Eric Sharamella, Sharamella, Sharamella. The CIA plant and analyst who just about everybody except the Intelligence Committee knows is the alleged Ukraine whistleblower. If we have time, and I'm kind of hoping we don't, we'll get back to the Swamp Circus a bit later on. But we do have to at least touch on a story that would be real news if we had an honest press. And it comes from the same source. Jim Hoft at the Gateway Pundit revealed, it says, Adam Schiff is connected to both companies named in that $7.4 billion Burisma U.S.-Ukraine corruption case. And if you happen to have been tuned to the criminally negligent networks when this one briefly came out, the chief prosecutor in Ukraine, no, not the guy that was ordered fired by creepy Joe Biden, has now indicted the owner, Nikolai Zlochevsky, of the corrupt Burisma Holdings there. Vice presidential son, Hunter Biden, has already been shown to have slurped up millions from the corrupt Ukrainian oil and gas company. And memos released earlier in the month revealed that Burisma Holdings pressured the Obama State Department, probably didn't take a whole lot of pressure, to help end the corruption investigation during the 2016 election cycle. Creepy Joe, of course, has famously bragged about getting Viktor Shokin fired during a 2018 speech to the Council on Foreign Relations, and the media immediately covered for the dastardly duo, saying that his targeting of the prosecutor, Viktor Shokin, was totally unrelated to the prosecutor's corruption investigation into his son and Burisma Holdings, which actually, though, did name-drop Hunter Biden when they were requesting aid from the State Department. Well, according to CD Media last week, former Ukrainian official Oleksandr Onyashenko said Hunter was receiving, quote, off-the-books payments from Burisma in the multiple millions. And since the former chief has been indicted in the Ukraine, he's mysteriously gone missing. But you've been waiting for it, right? There is more. Ringmaster and clown chief of the Deep State Swamp Circus, Adam Schiffless, is in fact linked to more than one of the U.S. corporations named in the $7.4 billion corruption case. Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. Schiff, say reports, is connected to both BlackRock and Franklin Templeton Investments. And although you probably won't hear any testimony on this particular subject from the House impeachment smokescreen, there are all kinds of other shady connections involved here, too. At a press conference of the Interfax Ukraine agency on Wednesday, Ukrainian MP Andriy Derkach announced that deputies have received new materials from investigative journalists about international corruption and the participation of, at least, Ukrainian officials in it. Quote, last week, November 14, the Prosecutor General's office, unnoticed by the media, announced a new suspicion to the notorious owner of Burisma, ex-ecology minister Zlochevsky. According to the suspicion, the Yanukovych family is suspected in particular with legalizing, or laundering, we would say here, criminally obtained income through Franklin Templeton Investments, an investment fund carrying out purchases of external government loan bonds totaling $7.4 billion. And with respect to the investigation, he emphasized, it was money criminally obtained by the Yanukovych family and invested in the purchase of Ukrainian debt between 2013 and 14. Furthermore, he said, investigators have determined that the Yanukovych family illegally obtained that $7.4 billion and laundered the funds through an investment fund close to, quote, some representatives of the U.S. Democratic Party in the form of external government loan bonds. And he went on to note that there were a number of other connections, including the son of Templeton's founder, John Templeton Jr., being one of Obama's major campaign donors. Another fund-related character is Thomas Donilon, managing director of BlackRock Investment Institute, and one of the largest shareholders in Franklin Templeton Investments. And, oh, it's also noteworthy, he added, that this man was formerly Obama's national security advisor.
These aren't the droids you're looking for.
These aren't the droids we're looking for. Move along. Move along.
Maybe after that we do need a bit of comic relief. I guess you could also add, this is the place where Elon Musk learns that there really is a creator of the universe, and he seems to have a sense of humor, too. The occasion was the much-anticipated unveiling of the incredible, and I guess that's an appropriate way to put it, Tesla Cybertruck. The theme of the unveiling was the incredible truck's durability. Said Musk at one point, "We created an exoskeleton," describing the truck's exterior, and it was something he literally hammered home, starting at the beginning of his presentation, when he had one of his assistants come on stage with a large sledgehammer and beat the door of the truck, which didn't budge. But that was the high point of the demo. Because when Musk switched to the windows of the new super truck and had his assistants demonstrate how normal glass shatters, and proved that by having his assistant drop a metal ball on a piece, the next step was to have an assistant throw a similar metal ball at the reinforced Cybertruck driver's side window, which promptly broke. And I can't actually quote what Elon the Magnificent said at that point, and the videos I found online were pretty well bleeped, but you definitely get the picture. And at least you can take a listen. First we have the wind-up, then the pitch, slow pitch, even as it was.
Sure? Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Well, maybe that was a little too hard. It didn't go through, that's a plus side.
Let's try that one.
Try that one, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Sure.
Oh, man.
It didn't go through. We threw everything, we even literally threw the kitchen sink at the glass, and it didn't break. For some weird reason, it broke now. I don't know why.
All right, well, he doesn't know, but just maybe somebody somewhere is trying to send a message. And would you believe they did the rest of the presentation with the now-damaged super truck sitting there in all of its smashed glory, right behind good old Elon. From there, it's time to enter into the not-so-way-back machine for a look at another kind of message that was clearly sent earlier in the week. Matter of fact, over the weekend, but didn't really make too much headlines and was quickly eclipsed by the impeach-at-any-cost circus, as we all knew would happen. Courtesy of Natural News, The Gateway Pundit, Infowars.com, and several local sources like Fox 59 News on the East Coast, President Trump made an unscheduled stop at the Walter Reed Military Hospital on Saturday over the weekend, evidently for a battery of tests to determine whether or not the president had been exposed to a chemical agent, you could say poison, suspected of being introduced into his food, said unnamed White House sources, now confirmed by the official White House physician. That report basically said nothing to see here, move along, saying, among other things, quote, "Despite some speculation, the president has not had any chest pain, nor was he evaluated or treated for any urgent acute issues." Beyond that, however, speculation divides along the Civil War lines. The internet is abuzz, says the Gateway Pundit summary, that President Trump was the victim of an attempted poisoning from the right, or was plotting a convenient way to resign, says the convenient left-wing fantasy. What we do know is this. The hospital visit was not listed on the president's public schedule, according to media outlets which indicated that the visit was not a routine physical exam. As the Fox 59 report put it, medical staff at Walter Reed did not get a staff-wide notice about a presidential visit to the medical center in Bethesda, Maryland, ahead of Trump's arrival, according to that source. Typically, though, Walter Reed medical staff would get a general notice about a VIP visit to the medical center ahead of any such presidential visit, notifying them of certain closures at the facility. And that didn't happen this time, meaning the visit was a non-routine one and scheduled at the last minute. Evidently initiated by the sudden onset of symptoms experienced by the president's food tester, a.k.a. the White House chief chef, who was reported stricken with such severe symptoms that urgent medical tests were conducted on that person while the president was diverted to Walter Reed for a priority medical examination involving a battery of chemical tests. Many conservatives, noted the Gateway Pundit summary, including the now railroaded into prison Roger Stone, as well as Alex Jones, whom they seem to have their sights on next, have been warning about such a poisoning event as a possibility ever since Trump was elected. And InfoWars reports that doctors and staff reportedly found the byproduct of a type of toxin that's very hard to detect, and here's the key, folks, has a time-delayed onset of symptoms. And historically, time-delayed poisons were popular with assassins due to their ability to get past the food tasters and other chemical tests that are usually done on food before it's eaten and onto the intended target before symptoms show up. Said InfoWars coverage, the toxin seems to be a newer concoction that's not typically tested for since it's not well known, according to the source. During the Clinton administration, reports former White House chief chef Walter Scheib, that job was designated the presidential food taster. And according to Paul Bedard at the Washington Examiner, he said, yeah, the chef is the taster. We're the last ones to taste it before it goes out. And what's more, he added, the White House has an elaborate system to keep food for the first family and even state dinners safe. Primarily, the kitchen works with companies that have undergone background checks, saying, discretion is valued. If you find somebody bragging about that, you shouldn't trust them. And interestingly, they note, Scheib also said sometimes the most secure way to serve food to the president is just, quote, go to the store and shop at the last moment, which, they added, might explain Trump's ongoing penchant for fast food. And you know what, folks? Come to think of it, as unhealthy as McDonald's might be, it probably beats Ricin'. And as you may recall, there's been considerable indications that the Secret Service agent who died while traveling with President Trump in July 2018 to Europe was in fact poisoned. Where the 19-year-old Secret Service veteran, who was in good health before the trip, suddenly died during the visit to Scotland of a massive stroke. Even Attorney General William Barr, in a recent speech before the Federalist Society, admitted that something seems to have reached a new level, and he warned that the lawless left is resorting to a troubling array of tactics in their effort to try to destroy the president by any means necessary and overthrow the republic. Quote, immediately after President Trump won election, opponents inaugurated what they call the resistance, and they rallied around an explicit strategy of using every tool and maneuver to sabotage the functioning of the executive branch and his administration. Now, he said, resistance is the language used to describe insurgency against rule imposed by an occupying military power, and it obviously connotes that the government is not legitimate. This, he said, is very dangerous and indeed an incendiary notation to import into the politics of a democratic republic. They essentially see themselves engaged in a war to cripple, by any means necessary, a duly elected government, unquote. And notes Mike Adams, along the same lines, to carry out various chemical poisoning operations, deep state operatives have access to a vast array of chemical poisons. Hey, guess whose tax dollars funded those? With a wide variety of biochemical mechanisms. And as most of us have known and even pointed out for years, among those, it's pretty easy to make somebody at least appear to have died of a massive stroke or a heart attack or pick your tragedy. The fact that the Democrats' attempted impeachment of the president is rapidly collapsing, combined with what's mildly put as the extremely disappointing lineup of far-left candidates for the 2020 election, may have now motivated anti-Trump deep state operatives, he says, to escalate their war to the level of carrying out, well, I guess I'd have to put it this way, yet another attempted assassination. Certainly, we've already seen that ethics, morality, or for crying out loud, their oath of office to the Constitution, or even the Ten Commandments, haven't slowed them down, so arguably this shouldn't surprise us in the least. In his commentary, Alex Jones put it this way, you don't want to assassinate Trump outright anyway, because that would turn him into a martyr, so you have to kill him slowly or drug him with chemicals to make him act loopy so that you can remove him via the 25th Amendment. And finally, your host led the following observation that I don't see in any of these commentaries, and it's just simply possible that what's being done here is to send yet another message to the president. Obviously, we know where you live, and clearly, we seem to be able to get to you in a way that you might not be able to stop. So, you'd better stop it, or we won't. So let me put it this way. If the deep state is really as threatened as they certainly ought to be, and we hope they are, and if you have any doubts remaining on that score, folks, look at what they've already done to the rule of law on literally every front. They know, and we should, that this is a fight to the death. From there, we move on to what, in hindsight now, certainly looks like an admission from the shiftless one, who spoke on Saturday at the annual California, where else, Democrat Party Convention for the far, far, far left of the far left. During his speech, Shifty admitted that the entire purpose of his show trials to undermine the Republic is to impeach, quote, the charlatan in the White House, adding that we will, quote, send him back to the golden throne he came from. He didn't say it, but the rest of us already know this is the case. By hook or by crook, by lie or deception, and bottom line, by any means necessary. And as the week progressed, of course, we saw there was another agenda at play, too, and that is to provide a smokescreen for the real criminality that you're not about to hear from the House Intelligence Sick Committee. says Jim Hoff for the Gateway Pundit in their coverage, and this is the guy running the impeachment show trials and controlling who can speak or if they can speak, who will test the lie publicly, which transcripts will be released, and even which questions are allowed to be asked. And as you know, Schiff has already threatened any lawmaker who mentions the name that shall not be named. Yeah, the anti-Trump CIA plant whistleblower, Eric Sciaramella. Sciaramella, Sciaramella. We certainly can't recap a week like this one without a look back at one of the week's biggest hypocrites. Gun-banning, constitution-hating, and now announced wannabe dictator, Michael Bloomberg. The former mayor of New York told the congregation at a black megachurch on Sunday that he's sorry for his support of the city's anti-constitutional, controversial, so-called stop-and-frisk program, which targeted a disproportionate number of blacks and Latinos. I was wrong, and I am sorry, unquote, said the lying hypocrite at the Christian Cultural Center in Brooklyn, pandering to the black vote, as Zero Hedge noted. And here's the part of this story that ought to really stick in your craw, folks. That is, if you're far more literate than even the best of the far-left contenders for next dictator of the United States. When it comes to the Bill of Rights, the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, of course, that Michael Bloomberg seems to detest almost as much as the Second, says the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. And a whole bunch of other stuff that he doesn't care about either. Hey, and that applies even if you call it stop and frisk, and refers to something that Michael Bloomberg probably doesn't have a clue about. It's called a search warrant. Now, here's the problem with this, and here's the issue that the far-left press just kind of universally tends to overlook. It doesn't have anything in that Fourth Amendment about unless the person is black or even unless the person is white, in which case, based on their racial profile or whatever else you may decide to make up, you still need a stinking warrant. And they don't like to talk about this either. The warrant is actually supposed to be based on probable cause. Zero Hedge does provide some interesting statistics, saying that in 2011, the year with the most unconstitutional stop and frisks, 685,724 NYPD stops were recorded. And of those, 88% were innocent, while 87% were black or Latino, 9% white, and over half were between 14 and 24 years of age. And let me say this again, just so it sinks in. 100% of them, though, were violations of that so-called police officer's oath of office. The Bill of Rights detesting scumbag Bloomberg, and I think I might be being a little bit too kind, had this to say regarding his unconscionable violation of that oath he took before a God and a people, both of whom he clearly detests. And this is certainly a candidate for hypocrisy of the year. Quote, over time, i.e. the last few years or weeks, I've come to understand something that I long struggled to admit to myself. I got something important wrong. I got something important really wrong.
That's my story. Oh, that's my story. Well, I ain't got a witness, and I can't prove it. But that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, he said, I got something important really wrong. And that's the understatement of the decade. I didn't understand back then the full impact that stops were having on the black and Latino communities. I was totally focused on saving lives. But as we know, good intentions aren't good enough. Unquote, said the lying scumbag who hasn't demonstrated a good intention in his entire oath-breaking career. And notice that he doesn't say, I was wrong because I took an oath to the Constitution and I violated the hell out of it. Because Bloomberg notably supported the stop and frisk practice after the 2013 ruling in which a federal judge declared the program unconstitutional. There's a big duh for you. And it turns out, on top of that, that about 90% of those stopped hadn't done anything illegal anyway. While the Rolling Stone reported that a 2018 Equal Justice Initiative report revealed that the city's abandonment of the totalitarian tactic had virtually no influence on crime rates at all either. Oh yeah, he's really chastened, not because he's a serial oathbreaker, but because now he's got some pandering to do. And he's not about to admit he was wrong about either the Fourth Amendment or the Second for anything approaching the right reasons. How many people have his gun-banning efforts already killed? And far more importantly, how many people is he willing to kill as he brings his gun banning efforts to totalitarian fruition? I guess the only good news here is they're no longer even trying to hide the level of evil that's at play. We'll be right back.
Did you write the book of love, and do you have faith in God above? If the Bible tells you so, how do you believe in rock and roll?
Welcome back now to the second segment for this evening. I'm your host, Mark Hall. And let's start this one off with a reminder about the conditioning so many Americans are undergoing. It's not sustainable, says the headline from Zero Hedge. PG&E, you know them, the communist California major power supplier, is instituting yet more rolling blackouts, expected to hit 181,000 customers Wednesday. And seriously, it begins every time the wind blows in the People's Republic of California, it transforms, not much of a transformation anymore, your host notes, into a third world country with rolling blackouts. And they add, if you've ever been to, say, South America, where it happens all the time, it's not a pleasant thing to experience. So, Californians are going to get yet another taste of what it's like to live in Venezuela, as if walking down the streets of San Francisco wasn't enough of a reminder. Over 180,000 customers in Northern California are expected to see their power cut off so that Pacific Gas and Electric can, at least allegedly, avoid sparking another deadly wildfire. Or maybe not. But at least the conditioning will continue. Other places in the communist, socialist, Islamic world elsewhere, outside of the People's Republic even, got their own dose of conditioning this week. We got several stories on that score, starting with Iran, where over 100 protesters have been killed in what's being called the largest internet shutdown in that nation's history. Now we're 5 days into widespread protest, begins the piece, in some 100 Iranian cities after a dramatic gas price hike last Friday. Fuel prices as much as tripled in various places, and in protest, people took to the streets and set government buildings, banks, and gasoline stations ablaze. And Amnesty International now reports that at least 106 people have already been killed, but the organization believes the real death toll may be much higher. Some reports suggest as many as 200 have been killed, said Amnesty in a statement, and this as government has cut off internet access across much of the country, resulting in a few videos, well, fewer than there would have been anyway, of clashes with police finally reaching the West, as in the early couple of days of the unrest. To the point where even the United Nations is now urging Iran to lift the internet blockage and show restraint after what that body has called clearly very serious extent of casualties. And demonstrators claim they're being fired on with live ammunition. The internet blockage began over the weekend, leaving some 80 million citizens without online access. And given the internet blackout, it's being described as extremely difficult, and maybe that's part of the reason, for outsiders to get an accurate overall estimate of the carnage. Which brings us next to Communist China, or maybe Hong Kong, which isn't communist yet, but it seems that the Communist Chinese are trying to change that really hard. It's like something out of a movie, says one of the stories from yesterday, concerning the 100 or so students who remain trapped inside the campus at Hong Kong's Polytechnic University. Hundreds more have either already escaped or surrendered to the inevitable. As police, and some would suggest Chinese military, surround the campus and have warned protesters there's only one way out, and that's in handcuffs. Because it sounds like even escape through the sewers has been removed as an option by this point. Meanwhile, other stories, like this one reported by BBC News, are attracting attention about those who've also been implicated in the continuing riots. Simon Cheng, a Hong Kong citizen who worked for the British Consulate General in Hong Kong, was arrested and tortured by Chinese agents for 15 days back in August for his alleged involvement in supporting the pro-democracy protests there, according to the BBC News. He told them he was, quote, shackled, blindfolded, and hooded, and then beaten into submission. Chinese agents accused him of sparking political unrest in Hong Kong that has since led to the economic and social collapse of that city. Quote, they said I'm a state enemy and I'm a traitor, and they also asked whether the consulate instructed me to mingle with the protest, he told the BBC, adding they wanted to know what role the UK had in the Hong Kong protests. They asked about support, money, and equipment, and what we were giving to the protesters. I told them I want to make it 100% clear. The UK didn't assign resources or help with the protests. The Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, has released a statement for his office of the British Consulate General there in Hong Kong and said they were shocked and appalled by the mistreatment that Ching experienced during that 15-day detainment, adding, quote, I've made it clear we expect the Chinese authorities to investigate and hold those responsible to account. And, of course, if you've been following the legal system, either in communist China or increasingly trending towards communist America with a K, you know the answer is don't hold your breath, especially if you're a friend of Trump, like Roger Stone. Meanwhile, lawmakers in Hong Kong have said that Cheng's arrest is a prime example of the abuse of the legal system there and why Hong Kongers have been protesting for the last 5 months as they attempt to try, at least, and prevent it from coming there. Said Willie Lam, an adjunct professor with the Chinese University of Hong Kong Center for China Studies, to Bloomberg, quote, Beijing is throwing down further signs of disrespect for the rule of law and taking a vindictive attitude toward Hong Kong citizens, particularly those with links to foreign countries. All of which may have had something to do with the Senate angering communist China yesterday by passing a bill requiring annual certification of Hong Kong's autonomy by the communist government and warning Beijing against what they've been doing, violently suppressing protesters. And in response to the unanimous Senate vote, pretty much as expected, the China Foreign Ministry said they strongly condemn the U.S. Senate measure on Hong Kong and resolutely oppose such action, while calling for the U.S. to stop interfering in affairs with China and, of course, their wannabe puppet state, formerly Free Hong Kong, and they demanded the latest bills on Hong Kong be stopped from becoming law. In a lengthy, that I mentioned, long-winded, and as Zero Hedge put it, very strong statement, the Foreign Ministry spokesperson Yang Shuang said, on November 19th, the U.S. Senate passed the Hong Kong Bill of Rights on Human Rights and Democracy, adding, this bill disregards the facts, confuses right and wrong, no argument, all of Congress is good at that, violates the axioms, plays with double standards, openly intervenes in Hong Kong affairs, interferes in China's internal affairs, and seriously violates the basic norms of international law and international relations. And it says, as if it hadn't already made that clear, that the Chinese side strongly condemns and resolutely opposes this. Meanwhile, note Zero Hedge, stocks and the yuan tumbled in response when they passed that bipartisan bill called S-1838, requiring an annual review of whether the city of Hong Kong is sufficiently autonomous from Beijing to justify its special trading status. And in doing so, says Tyler Durden, the Senate has delivered a warning to China against violent suppression of the demonstrations, and that stands in stark contrast to President Donald Trump's near silence on the issue, the result of a behind-the-scenes agreement, evidently, whereby China would allow the S&P to rise indefinitely as long as Trump kept his mouth shut. The legislation, they note, comes at a difficult time for Trump as the administration is trying to complete the first phase of that long-awaited trade deal with China. Earlier on Tuesday, Vice President Mike Pence had said that it would be difficult for the U.S. to sign a trade agreement with China if the demonstrations in Hong Kong were met with violence. Quote, the president's made it clear it'll be very hard for us to do a deal with China if there's any violence or if that matter is not treated properly and humanely, said Pence in an interview with an Indianapolis-based radio station. And although other sources say the big question is how China will really react, there are some clues. Shortly after 2 a.m., the notorious China Twitter troll, the editor of the Global Times, Hu Jijing, said, China wants a trade deal, but is prepared for the worst-case scenario, which he called a prolonged trade war. Your host, on the other hand, remains unconvinced that that's really the worst case. And so, evidently, is Michael Snyder, who weighed in on the increased economic tensions associated with Hong Kong and China, calling it the Red Horse. As China now threatens the U.S. with revenge for daring to side with the Hong Kong protesters, a new Cold War, he says, has officially begun, and it could potentially throw the entire world into a state of chaos. And as you'll see, and he'll go through, China is warning the U.S. to rein in that horse at the edge of the precipice as the conflict between our two nations threatens to spiral out of control. As I mentioned earlier in the week, First the Senate and now the House of Representatives have both passed the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act of 2019, and the new law is essentially a public declaration that the United States government fully supports the protesters in Hong Kong. And as you know, the protests have been escalating and continuing now for about 5 months. Since the beginning of the siege, hundreds of protesters have been injured and more than 1,000 have been arrested. It's a major crisis, and Congress even finally felt compelled to do something. Reuters reports that Trump is expected to sign the bill, and even for some reason he didn't, there are more than enough votes now, bipartisan as it might be, to override any veto. Which means the next election, or even the impeachment, won't really change anything, and siding with the Hong Kong protesters will still be official U.S. policy, regardless of what happens in the circus or who wins in 2020. Needless to say, though, adds Snyder, the Chinese are extremely angry about the new law, and the official newspaper of the ruling Communist Party is warning that the Chinese intend to take, quote, resolute revenge. And Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Zheng Shuang is now warning that the United States should brace for, quote, strong countermeasures. Says Michael Snyder, we're not just talking about a trade war anymore. The Chinese now view us as enemy number one, and they are going to play hardball. And I wish, he said, I could get everyone to understand just how serious this is. Most Americans couldn't care less about what happens over in China, but the Chinese have been steaming about U.S. interference in their affairs for months. Yes, he continues, supporting the protesters is certainly the noble thing to do, but by publicly insulting China's national honor and directly assaulting China's sovereignty over once-free Hong Kong, Congress has set in motion a chain of events that nobody is going to be able to control. Oh, and here I'll insert not only a couple of new comments from recent editorials and economic observations, but some that I've been covering for quite a while. It's not like China hasn't got tons of economic problems on its own. They've been stimulating like there's no tomorrow, borrowing, kind of like the United States. And essentially what more and more analysts are waking up to is what's being called the limits of stimulus. As Thomas Malernan at GNSE Economics this week put it, it's been clear for some time that China's economy is on an unsustainable path, and because of the massive levels of debt and unproductive investments now in place, the economy of China is heading to a crash. In other words, they too are running out of rope, and the day of reckoning is near. So that adds a little bit more fuel to the fire. Michael Snyder, for his part, goes on to summarize some of the economic news that we've already been talking about and adds that as the two largest economies on the planet decouple from one another, it's going to cause global economic activity as a whole to dramatically slow down. Corporate revenues will fall, credit markets will start to tighten, and fear will increasingly creep into global financial markets. Says Snyder, I've repeatedly warned that conditions are ideal for our first major crisis, at least admitted crisis, since 2008, and this conflict with China could be more than enough to push us over that edge. He then goes on to summarize some of the recent Chinese military threats as well, and advancements in things like their submarine-launched ballistic missile capability and nuclear arsenals, adding that we're not at that point yet, but without a doubt, the Chinese now consider us to be their primary global enemy. For the moment, it's just a cold war that we're facing, and the Chinese are quite adept at playing global chess. Bottom line here, and this is the warning to the wise, the Chinese have, quote, a lot of ways that they can hurt us, and most Americans don't realize this. So does the Fed, and sadly, there's probably even less Americans that realize that. Midweek, though, the minutes of the last Fed Open Market Committee meeting, so widely anticipated from the summit of Mount Olympus, were released to what's still called the investing public. And they signal that any further rate cuts are on hold, despite what they admit are, quote, elevated downside risks. Stock markets pretty much across the board continue to be down a bit. Gold and silver, the real money alternatives, even in the paper form, having already been hammered, didn't suffer too much more abuse this week at the hands of the paper manipulators. And that means the best brief summary of the rest of the economic picture that your host has seen again comes from Michael Snyder at places like the Economic Collapse blog, one of his own websites, and I saw him up on LouRockwell.com with the headline, Brace for Impact. The U.S. economy is going down, and it's going down hard. He begins by saying, I've got so many bad economic numbers to share with you, I don't even know where to begin. I'd anticipated the U.S. economic slowdown would accelerate during the fourth quarter of this year, and that's precisely what happened. Even though the Fed's trying to do all they can to officially keep us from slipping into a recession, and the FedGov is literally spending money as if tomorrow will never come. But still, all of that intervention just hasn't been enough to reverse the increasing downside economic momentum. Which kind of helps make it increasingly clear why it's now time that the circus has come to town. Which finally brings us back to the Bolshevik Revolution in America with a K, and the circus in the swamp. But let's introduce it with a couple of salient comments from Tucker Carlson, one of the few bright spots remaining at Faux News Network, who spent a couple of minutes doing a great job of comparing and contrasting the treatment of the Achtung Verboten, Deep State Hates You, Roger Stone, with that of, well, they really kind of love him, whether he's still alive or not, Jeffrey Epstein. And as Tucker put it, yeah, it's just so you know the rules in this country.
You remember what happened when Roger Stone was arrested earlier this year? Dozens of federal agents with automatic weapons, armored vehicles, and a helicopter descended on his home in a middle-class part of Fort Lauderdale and rousted the 66-year-old and his wife from bed at rifle point. And just to make sure the event inflicted maximum humiliation, the feds tipped off CNN, which was there to capture the whole thing live, which they did. That's how our government treated a man facing perjury charges.
And, of course, Bill Clinton once faced perjury charges. He certainly didn't get that kind of treatment. Of course, he was guilty of rape, too, and that didn't really come up at all. Neither did treason, but we're getting used to that by now, aren't we? On the other hand, John Brennan and James Clapper are both obviously guilty of perjury, at least before Congress, and they haven't faced anything.
Now, Jeffrey Epstein, by contrast, was accused of molesting at least 34 separate underage girls. How was he arrested? Actually, that's a trick question. He wasn't arrested. According to the New York Times account, prosecutors called Jeffrey Epstein's lawyer and politely asked him to turn himself in, which Epstein politely did. Nobody tipped off CNN. In fact, just the opposite happened. Authorities tried to keep the whole thing secret in order to preserve Jeffrey Epstein's dignity.
And you know what? We don't really even have time to go through all the other things that the feds did to really lay down the red carpet for good old Jeffrey. Suffice it to say that whether you believe Jeffrey's dead or not, or just kicking back on a beach somewhere, when they complete the final solution on Roger Stone, he probably really will be dead. Because among other things, it certainly looks like the intent here is to send a message. Or maybe I should say resend the message. Some of us are getting tired of hearing by now. When all is said and done here, folks, I guess you could describe the difference between the treatment of real criminals that just happen to be, literally, I guess you'd say, in bed with the deepest of the deep state, as opposed to those who actually aren't even in that same bedroom, as kind of like the difference between Epstein getting the kid glove treatment and Roger Stone getting the jackboot treatment. Well, if we're ready now for the impeachment farce update, we'll try to get it over with as quickly and painlessly as possible. And interestingly, the deep state's obviously trying to do the same thing with the republic, except for the painless part. And let's start here. This is really probably my favorite story of the day on this score. Writes Christina Lehler for the Gateway Pundit, Congressman Lee Zeldin said what we were all finally thinking on Tuesday during day three of the Schiffstorm show trial. The New York Republican called out the shiftless one and Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, who still laughably maintained they don't even know the name of that whistleblower and CIA snitch, Eric Charamella. And think about it. If they really didn't know his name, isn't there at least a chance, if he was so central to this whole impeachment circus, that they might have accidentally said it without knowing it? When Zeldin tweeted on Tuesday, quote, if Adam Schiff and LTC Vindman don't know who the whistleblower is, well then how would they know that naming the one person LTC Vindman spoke to in the intelligence community would out the whistleblower? Unquote. Isn't it funny, folks? They don't know the name of the one who must not be named, and yet there's only one name that they so studiously avoid. How could they not know it? Otherwise, they might have just said it by accident, and whoo, wouldn't that have caused some fireworks? Shifty's beady demonic eyes might have just popped right out of his head. Oh, and if you think about it, this too is at least a bit funny, given that Roger Stone has gone to jail for a whole lot less. Vindman clearly not only knows the identity of the whistleblower, because he was Charamella's primary source of leaks, but he evidently must have perjured himself when he's testified repeatedly, although behind closed doors, that he didn't know who it was that was feeding him the information that he's in turn been feeding on second and third hand. Come on. But wait, there is a bit more. This one comes from a summary via Zero Hedge. the man who's demonstrating what courts-martial were once supposed to be about, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, testified for several hours on Tuesday, and after that abuse, they note, along with testifying from Russia advisor Jennifer Williams, we now know, or at least have confirmation of the following. Despite being a so-called Ukraine expert, Vindman says he had no idea, no trust him on this one, that the perhaps crime-connected, but certainly crooked, Ukrainian natural gas company, Burisma, had routed over $3 million into accounts tied to Hunter Biden. Here's the question from Devin Nunes, and let's hear the response right from the horse's, mouthpiece.
As you know, that financial records show a Ukrainian natural gas company, Burisma, routed more than $3 million to the American accounts tied to Hunter Biden.
I'm not aware of this fact.
Until recently.
I guess I didn't independently look into it. I'm just not aware of, what kind of payments Mr. Biden may have received. This is not something I'm aware of.
All right, well, let's see. The man who overrides the president on foreign policy, especially when it comes to the Ukraine, because he knows so much more than the duly elected president, wasn't done yet.
Did you know that Burisma's American legal representatives met with Ukrainian officials just days after Vice President Biden forced the firing of the country's chief prosecutor?
I'm not aware of these meetings.
Did you know that Burisma lawyers pressured the State Department in February 2016 after the raid and a month before the firing of Shokin, and that they invoked Hunter Biden's name as a reason to intervene?
I'm not aware of any of these facts.
I know nothing!
Sergeant Schultz, though, was at least honest, and certainly a better officer than this guy. But Nunes had one more question on this thread.
Did you know that Joe Biden called Ukrainian President Poroshenko at least three times in February 2016 after the president and owner of Burisma's home was raided on February 2nd by the state prosecutor's office?
I'm aware of the fact that President Biden or Vice President Biden was very engaged on Ukraine and had numerous engagements. That's what I'm aware of.
Now wait a minute. Isn't that kind of interesting? He's aware of something that sounds like, even if you know nothing about it, it's a lot more serious than whatever it is that he decided to blow the whistle, even if it was third hand, on concerning this president. Doesn't that kind of stink to high heaven? When it comes to real corruption, in other words, he knows a little bit about it, but doesn't blow the whistle. And when it comes to corruption that's actually been publicly admitted, what was it he kept saying?
I'm not aware of these meetings. I'm not aware of any of these facts.
I see nothing. I know nothing.
And yet this guy is the expert. He knows more than the elected president. He knows more than his own chain of command, as other stories made clear. Wrote Jim Hoff for the Gateway Pundit, Tim Morrison destroyed the shiftless one's top witness, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, when the national security aide and Russian expert testified alongside former Ambassador Kurt Volker and said under oath that Vindman, the leaker who reports to him, could not be trusted. Responding to issues of complaints concerning Vindman, Tim Morrison said they had concerns about his judgment, for reasons that now appear more than obvious. He was then asked by Counsel Castor, were there concerns Colonel Vindman had leaked information? Response, yes. And added, if he had concerns about the content of a call, that was something I should have been notified of. Asked Counselor Castor, did he become frustrated that he was cut out of some of the Ukraine portfolio? Answer, yes. And just to kind of bring home the fact that Vindman's claim he respected the chain of command was yet another lie, he was asked by Representative Winstrup, you said you respect the chain of command. Did you go to your direct boss, Tim Morrison? To which Vindman responded, at least this time, honestly, no, I didn't. He does seem, however, to have gone to a whole lot of the deep state and the press. Wrote Sean Davis in conclusion, that hearing with Vindman, who's clearly the intelligence community's patient zero in the latest iteration of Democrats' anti-Trump coup theater, could not have gone more poorly for the Bolsheviks, and he said his testimony was a disaster for impeachment efforts. But you've probably already guessed, folks, that isn't going to slow him down because evidence was never part of the equation anyway. And when you compare what the press does focus on, folks, as opposed to what's important and that they ignore, the pattern is pretty darned obvious. Thankfully, though, there are members of Congress that still have not only some integrity, but the ability to demonstrate what the real issue is here to the American people. Says another piece from Jim Hoft at the Gateway Pundit, Representative John Ratcliffe, Republican of Texas and a former U.S. attorney from that state, has destroyed the sham impeachment circus hearings with a single effort. He word searched the entire testimony catalog and even brought copies of every single set of witness testimony to the hearing and laid them on the witness stand and found that not one single so-called witness had actually used the word bribery to describe either President Trump or the Trump administration's actions toward Ukraine. He then pointed out that the word bribery only came up after it was first poll tested by the Democrats. Which kind of sounds like an admission that dumbed down people don't really care what the law says so much as what they can be convinced to swallow.